Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, go to the events page. And if you live, you know, up in that Great Lakes area, you know, in Minnesota, in that area, you should come check out the A Life Lived in Christ conference. It's a conference about Christ and the Christian. And it's going to be a good time. It's a one-day event out in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. So I'm looking at you, Minneapolis and Fargo and whatever else is in driving distance from there. We'd love to have you come out. It's only $20 to register for that event, and registration is now open. But here's the thing. When you register for that event, you get a free pre-release copy of Gretchen Ronovich's new book, Ragged. You're going to get that, and Gretchen will be speaking at that event as well. In fact, it's at her church. So $20 gets you into the event and a copy of the book before anyone else gets it. Well, not anyone else. I have it, and Chad has it. But we can vouch for it, Chad. It's amazing. So you should definitely come and check that out. I'll put a link in the show notes, or you can go to the events page and find it there. Chad, you were just hanging out here in Arkansas. This is our first recording since the Northwest Arkansas regional event, which went pretty well. It was awesome. A good time.
It was a good time. Yeah, I mean, we had a great turnout, great conference, great speakers. You've been bragging about Northwest Arkansas for basically the whole time I've known you, right?
Yeah.
Telling everybody what an awesome place it is, and as it turns out, you're right. Yeah. It is. It's a very cool place. My wife and I had a great time. We hung out actually a couple extra days and checked out some of the surrounding area. The city itself is cool. The area around it's beautiful. So hopefully we'll be heading back that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was a good time, man. You could tell that people, you know, when you do an event like that and it sells out so fast, and then, you know, just being there, you could tell that people were excited to be together again. I mean, that was,
you couldn't have had
an easier crowd to talk to, man. They were ready for it.
Yeah. We were all like, we were starving for like face-to-face human interaction. And thankfully we had a lot of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was fun. I'm sure the videos from that event will be coming out soon. So they're being edited and everything right now, but all the talks and all the, I think even the music and stuff is going to be released, so you guys can enjoy that.
Good.
All right. Well, we are in 2 Samuel chapter 6. David is now kicking it as king over all of Israel. He's taken Jerusalem and beat down some Philistines. So chapter 5 is kind of an eventful chapter. He gets crowned king officially, takes the capital city, or what will be the capital city, and just beats down a bunch of enemies. And, you know, kind of makes friends with Tyre. And so there's a lot that's going on in chapter 5. I think that maybe if you just read it, you would, you know, or maybe some of the significance of all those things would be lost on you because they happen so fast. But something else is going to happen in chapter 6 here that is also very significant.
Yeah. Yeah. Chapter 6 is a strange chapter. I mean, you got some marital problems coming up here. We got a case of David having trouble with one of his wives. So pretty interesting heated exchange between David and Michal. That's actually at the end of the chapter. And then you have probably one of the more well-known and unliked stories, actually, in the Old Testament. That is our friend Uzzah, or however you want to say his name. Most people say Uzzah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you have the case of Uzzah, and he's the guy who touched the ark. Big, big mistake. So we'll find out why he did and what happened to him.
Yeah, I think there's no way that Raiders of the Lost Ark doesn't pull a lot of its theology straight from the story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were they were totally right in that movie with 2 Samuel open in front of them. So you got that. And then, okay, what are you going to do with the Ark now? You know, so we have the story of the second attempt to transport the Ark, and David and his linen ephod dancing. And anyway, it's some pretty fascinating material for a lot of reasons coming up here. But we start out with something that's going to actually be important for us to keep in mind when we're reading about this transport of the ark. And that is the transport of an ark that took place back in 1 Samuel. So here's how the chapter starts out. And when it starts out this way, we're supposed to make a connection between what's happening here and what happened earlier. This is the first verse. It says, David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. All right, so you hear that and you're thinking, okay, I don't get it. What are we supposed to make a connection to? Well, that's 2 Samuel 6, verse 1. If you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 4, which is also about the Ark of the Covenant, except this is about the loss of the Ark of the Covenant. 1 Samuel chapter 4, verse 10 says that on the day that the Philistines took the Ark of the Covenant, 30,000 Israelite soldiers fell dead on the battlefield. So 30,000 there on the day the Ark was captured and taken by the Philistines. Now David gathers 30,000 men in order to go get the Ark of the Covenant from the place where it has been for the last long time. I mean, maybe a century or thereabout. So that number itself is supposed to kind of be a key to help us put both these stories kind of side by side. And we'll see some more examples of parallels between these two stories as well. So David gets up and takes all these people with him to, here it's called Baale Judah or Baal Judah. This is another name for a place that's called Kiriath Yearim. And Kiriath Yearim is the place where the Ark has been for all these decades. I think we talked about this in that earlier episode, but at least some archaeologists now think that Kiriath Yearim, that's the Old Testament name of the city, is the city that we know by the New Testament name of Emmaus, because of those two disciples that walked those 6 or 7 miles to Emmaus. There's been some findings in Emmaus, or findings in Kiriath Yearim, which lead archaeologists to believe actually these are one and the same place. So anyway, got three names. You could call it Emmaus, you could call it Kiriath Yearim, you can call it Baale Judah, but whatever you want to call it, it's the Ark City. That's where the Ark has been. So he brings all these guys, they go to this place, and it says which is called by the name, which is a pretty fascinating way to describe the Ark of the Covenant. The name, the very name of the Lord of Hosts, who is enthroned above the cherubim. So you're all familiar with the Ark of the Covenant. We talked about it lots of times, but you got these two cherubim. They're on one on either side. Their wings are outstretched. They're facing one another. And in the mind of the Israelites, that is the throne of God. So the base of that, which would be the seat of atonement, that's like the footstool. And the Lord's throne is invisibly between the two cherubim. And other texts will talk about how God puts his name there. His name is synonymous with himself. So where you have the name of God, there you have the presence of God. So God can later say that he's putting his name into the Holy of Holies in the temple. By that, he simply means he's putting himself. But the name of God and God himself are basically communicating the same thing. So we have these guys with David. They're going to get the ark. Now, their first mistake they make is they put the Ark of God on a cart, specifically referred to as a new cart. They make a mistake here because if you're familiar with the laws about the transportation of not only the Ark of the Covenant, but all the different parts of the tabernacle, first of all, only the Levites were supposed to carry these utensils, and actually one particular family or clan within the Levites were supposed to carry the parts of the tabernacle. And they weren't supposed to carry it by putting it into a cart. They were supposed to carry it by inserting the poles, and these poles would go on their shoulders. And so the Ark of the Covenant was supposed to be covered up. That's the way that the Ark was supposed to be transported. None of that happens here. There's no Levites involved. You've got a cart, a new cart. You don't have the poles on the shoulders of the Levites. So right from the beginning, the way they're transporting the Ark of the Covenant is not in conformity with the way God himself said he wanted his throne to be transported.
Yeah, you have to wonder if part of this is just because they got a ways to go, and they're like, man, I don't know, like getting the poles out, running them through the loops, then we're going to carry this thing all this way. You know, that's
sore shoulders.
Yeah, you're like, that's cool if you're moving it from, you know, this room to that room, or maybe you're moving it across town, but come on, man. The new cart is interesting. Maybe we're reading a little bit into this, but it seems that the thought has crossed their mind that we should be somewhat careful of how we transport this thing. Maybe a new cart that, and this is going to, I'm going to make a point about this later, but perhaps a new cart where something less holy has not been transported on it before, mm-hmm. Is the way to go. So we're not going to use just any old cart. Like, we're not going to use the cart that we hauled the hay in, or the cart that we hauled the, you know, the firewood in, or whatever. Mm-hmm. We'll build a brand new cart. Nothing's ever been transported on it, because this is the Ark after all. So this is going to matter in a minute.
Yeah. Yeah. I fully agree. I mean, that's actually, and that's kind of in conformity too with something that we see in other contexts. For instance, if you have a heifer that's going to serve as a sacrifice, like the red heifer, or other contexts where you have an animal, very often the language used to describe them is one that's never been worked. So you're wanting an animal that has never been subjected to the yoke. Those are typically reserved for this sacred purpose. I think it's the same reason, this is a side note, but I think the same reason that Jesus rode the donkey into Jerusalem, on which no one had yet been ridden. So it was saved for this special purpose.
These are all virgin things in that way, right? So this is a virgin cart.
This is a virgin cart.
And you understand what that means in the context of a person, but this is sort of applied to things and animals as well. Not that you need an animal that is a virgin in the way we think of virgins, but a virgin to the yoke, or a virgin, you know, hasn't been worked or hasn't been ridden, and that sort of thing.
And this, by the way, is another parallel. So we had the 30,000 men paralleling the first Samuel chapter 4 episode. So if you remember what happens, the Philistines take the ark, and then of course it ends up being basically a curse on every Philistine city where they take it. So they're going to ship it back home, right? And so they consult their wise men, and they're like, hey, we got to get rid of this thing. How should we give it back to the Israelites? And the Philistines are told that they are to prepare a new cart, and then to hook these cows up to it, and then let them haul it back. So in 1 Samuel chapter 6, verse 7, the same phrase in Hebrew that's used to describe the new cart there is the same Hebrew phrase that we have here in 2 Samuel chapter 6 to describe this new cart. So in a odd sort of way, it's like they're imitating the Philistines. You know, Philistines sent it back on a new cart, and now they're grabbing a new cart, and they're going to use that to transport the Ark of the Covenant. So anyway, they put it on the ark. I mean, they put it on the cart, and they are going to bring it along. So they bring it from the house of Abinadab, which is where it had been this whole time. And two of the sons of Abinadab, one is named Ahio, and the other is the guy we've already mentioned, Uzzah. So they're going to go along with it. So verse 4 says, they brought it with the ark of God from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And the one son, Ahio, he's walking ahead of the ark. So maybe he's, you know, he's leading the oxen or something like that. And what's going on all around him? Well, verse 5 says, David and all these Israelites, they're celebrating. They're celebrating with all these different kinds of instruments. They got lyres, harps, tambourines, castanets, cymbals. So they're making music. They're making song.
Sounds like a very modern worship band.
It does sound like a very modern worship band.
What, they weren't just marching with an organ? Sounds like they're willing to use all the instruments. Just saying.
Yeah, they had everything. You know, it's like the end of Psalm 150. All this long list of instruments.
Yeah. Do you play an instrument? Bring it out here.
Whatever you got, man.
We're celebrating before the Lord. So bring all your stuff.
You got some cymbals. You got some lyres. You got your guitar. You got your bagpipes. Whatever. Bring them on. So it looks like everything's great. Everybody's happy, singing, making music, celebrating, until they get to the threshing floor of Nacon, whoever this guy is. It's a threshing floor anyway. Something happens. We're not told exactly what happens. But, you know, maybe the ark, maybe the cart hit a hole, or maybe it ran over a rock, you know, or maybe the oxen were pulling it, they got startled by something and kind of went forward fast or jerked it to the right, whatever happened. Anyway, we're not told exactly, but we're told that the oxen nearly upset the cart. And when that happened, our friend Uzzah reached out toward the ark of God and he took hold of it. And verse 7 says, the anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and God struck him down there for, I'm going to fill in that blank in just a minute. So for something. And he died there by the ark of God. Yeah, let me fill in the blank first and we talk about this. So in First Chronicles, which is the parallel account to this, it just says God struck him down because he reached out his hand or something like that. The Hebrew that's here is, it's one simple short word, shawl, I believe is what it is. And it only occurs here and nobody really knows what it means. That's a problem if you have a Hebrew word that only occurs once, you can't find any parallels to it. How are you going to figure out what it means? You know, you've got nothing to compare it to. So New American Standard has that God struck him down for his irreverence. ESV says God struck him down because of his error, possibly. But again, it's debatable. It really doesn't matter, because the reason God struck him down is because he grabbed hold of the Ark of the Covenant, right? Simple as that. It doesn't matter if you would call it an error, you call it irreverence or something else. The action, it wasn't the motive behind it, but it was the action by which he grabbed hold of this most holy throne of God. That's what killed him.
Yeah, this is a story that bothers some people. It does seem, I mean, it says that, you know, he reached out and took hold of it for the oxen had stumbled, right? So for whatever reason, the oxen have done something that is, it seems that the ark is in danger of falling off the cart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Uzzah does what any of us might do, which is, you grab a hold of it, right? I mean, if you're moving something and it starts teetering, you might grab a hold of it to try to steady it. I mean, that's what it's always doing here. And
he might not have even thought about it.
Right.
You know, just, I mean, if we're carrying something and it starts to fall, I don't think to myself, oh, look, it's falling, I should probably reach out my hand and steady it. It's just an instant muscular reaction when you're carrying something you don't want to fall to grab it.
Yeah, and it seems that, obviously, we've discussed, maybe this is the reason you're not supposed to have it on a cart, right? You're not transporting this in the right way. But I don't think that his mistake is irreverence. I don't think it's that he doesn't revere the ark. I think his error, if we'll go with that translation, the error that he makes is that he believes what all of us believe, because our anthropology is not low enough, that the ark falling to the ground is somehow worse than the hand of a sinner being laid upon it. This is the mistake, because you're wrong. It is not worse for the ark of the Lord to touch the earth. It is not worse for that to happen than for you as a sinner to place your hand on it. That's the mistake. And that's a mistake I think most of us would make. We would be like, well, I mean, you don't want it to fall on the ground. I mean, you don't want it to get dirty. You don't want it to break or something. I'll just, as a sinner, reach out my hand and grab hold of the throne of God unmediated. This is a grave mistake. This is what you ought not do. Then he dies. I think this is a mistake that all of us constantly make, thinking that apart from a mediator, that we are more righteous than anything else around us, which is, we are the reason for this fallen world. There's nothing in the world more unrighteous than man.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to think about it. You know, another way to put it is, you know, we're not the ones responsible for keeping God from falling.
Yes.
Yes. We got things backward. The Ark of the Covenant is going to be fine if it touches the dirt. It's going to be fine if it falls. Yeah, the problem is the human contamination, yep, as you put it. Yeah, that is the issue.
Yeah.
It's a great reminder too, you know, that this is, you know, holy, the worship of God is beautiful. But we can't ever forget that it's also, it has this sort of, I don't know if danger is the right word to use or not, but they're in the Old Testament for sure. There is the kind of this, it's like, this is probably a poor analogy, but it's kind of like electricity. You know, electricity is wonderful and what a gift it is, but it also is dangerous. I guess, you know, makes me think of the quote about Aslan. You know, he's not a tame lion.
Yeah, well, I tell you this, worship of God is real dangerous without Jesus.
Yeah.
It's infinitely more dangerous apart from Christ.
You want that mediator.
Yeah, you're going to need that mediator if you're going to survive worship. Like, you're not going to survive worship apart from a mediator, because you're not going to do it right.
Right, yeah. Yeah, this whole incident reminds me, it's not the exact parallel, but, you know, the disciples are trying to keep people away from Jesus. You know, keep the little children away from Jesus, keep the people away from Jesus, keep him away from the dirt, as it were. That's why he came.
Yeah. You know,
he came to have contact with the things that we sometimes want to keep him away from. Whatever Uzzah's motivation was, the action put him in direct contact. A sinner's hand touched the Ark of the Covenant, which people, of course, were not supposed to touch. They weren't even really supposed to see it. And the result was that the wages of sin is death for him, as well as for all of us. That's the wages that sin pays. And that's why we have the new Ark of the Covenant. That's why we have the flesh and blood of Christ, because He's the one who, he's not going to kill you if you touch him. It's quite the opposite. He's like, come to me, touch me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. And not only that, but, you know, rather than killing people, he gives life. He gives cleansing. He gives all the things that he came to win for us.
Well, if you're clothed in the righteousness of Christ, you can then lay hold of God.
Yeah, yeah. John, I think it's 1 John chapter 1, where he says, that which we've looked at, which our hands have touched.
Yeah.
This we proclaim to you concerning the word of life. And that's why it's either Luke 24 or John 20, where Christ bids his disciples, you know, look, touch. Here's my wounds. Come up here and touch them if you want to. You can lay hold of me. And when you touch me, you touch God and you touch your life itself. You don't touch something that's going to kill you. You touch something that's going to enliven you.
Yeah. And none of that's to say that Uzzah wasn't a believer or anything like that. It's just to say that, the time had not yet come where you could lay hold of God in that way.
No, this was had to wait for the incarnation for that to happen.
Yes.
Well, David's response to all this is that he gets mad. David was angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah. And so they named that place the outburst of Uzzah, Perez Uzzah, to this day. So it's kind of an interesting parallel here. So if you look in the if you look at the two verses side by side, verse 7, you've got, I'm looking at the Hebrew here, you've got the anger of God. Literally, it's the burning of the nose of God broke out. And then in verse 8, you've got just kind of the burning of David. In both cases, it's anger. But the angers are paralleled. So God's anger burst out against Uzzah, kills him. But David is angry as well. It doesn't say he's angry at God, but it does say he's angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah. And this is one of a handful of situations I can think of in the Old Testament where people are angry either because of God or directly at God. We talked about one of those with Samuel. Samuel was angry because God was taking Saul away from being king. So David is angry here because of what God has done. I mean, talk about raining on David's parade.
Yeah, well, I'm sure David, this is one of the things you got to love about David, is David is no doubt upset. He's probably, God, I'm trying to do a good thing here. I'm trying to bring your ark into the capital city. What? You just kill this guy?
Just kill this guy? Yeah.
You know, this is ridiculous.
It's a great example of how the best, I don't care how good your motivations are. I mean, ultimately, it's not up to you and your motivations. It's up to God and his word, right? God had made it very clear how he wanted his ark to be transported. David didn't do it. So, yeah, you might have great motivations. You might have, you know, the purest of reasons for doing something. But if it's contrary to what God has said, well, then who cares about your motivations? Who cares about your reasons? It all goes back to, this is God's ark, and so God gets to describe how he wants his ark to be transported.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen? Well, verse 10, David was unwilling to move the ark of the Lord into the city of David with him. No surprise there. So what's he going to do with it? This is astonishing to me, because he says he took it to the house of a guy named Obed-Edom. Now, that's not so astonishing, but Obed-Edom is described as the Gittite. And the Ark of God remains in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, for 3 months. And God blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. Now, what's astonishing about that? A Gittite means that guy is from Gath. Gath is the Philistine city. So the Ark of God stays for 3 months in the home of a Gentile, which is just pretty phenomenal when you think about the whole history of the Ark of the Covenant. It's of course for the Israelites, and what happened the last time that the Philistines got a hold of the Ark of the Covenant? Well, it was a curse to them. Everywhere they took it, you know, their God was falling on his face, and then his head and his hands are cut off, and then there's a plague breaking out in all these Philistine cities. And now, because this is the important part, because this Philistine has become part of the people of Israel, then God blesses his house, because God is staying for 3 months in this house of a Gentile via his Ark of the Covenant. So yeah. Rather than a curse, it ends up being a blessing to him.
Yeah, I'm assuming this family did not touch it.
Yeah, thankfully. I'm sure they wised up. They don't open it. Don't touch it. You know, if I was Obed-Edom, I'd be like, okay, put it in that back room, and we're locking the door.
Yeah.
Ain't nobody going in there. Nobody's going to have any contact with us.
Yeah, and of course, David's going to get wind of, yeah, this guy's getting blessed. And then that seems like the motivation that David's like, man, we really do got to get this ark over here.
So we're going to go, this can be 2.0, so we're going to try it again. So he hears that God has blessed the house of Obed-Edom. So he's like, well, let's try it again. So they went to his house, and they retrieved it, and they brought it into the city of David. So that's verse 12. And then we have a description here of some of the activities that happened while they were transporting it. It says, the bearers of the ark of the Lord. Now, that indicates that they've figured out how they're supposed to carry it now. They went six paces, and they sacrificed an ox and a fatling. By the way, I think that's easy to misread, as if like every six paces they had a sacrifice. The Hebrew would indicate that this just means they went six paces. Maybe they brought it outside or something like that, and then they offered these sacrifices. I don't think they were offering an ox and a fatling every six paces.
Took them a year and a half to get to the...
Yeah, from Emmaus, every 7 miles. I mean, somebody could do the math, but that'd be a lot of dead animals, yeah. Between Emmaus and Jerusalem. So they make the sacrifice, and David is dancing before the Lord with all his might, and he's wearing, is because a linen ephod is connected with what the priest would wear. So here we have David, king, wearing priestly garments. Now, this is not the first, and it will not be the last time that we see kings performing priestly functions. Now, I know that in the Old Testament, these are different offices. Of course they are, but we have plenty of examples. We saw Saul, the first king, offering sacrifices. We have David wearing the priestly attire, dancing before the Ark of the Covenant. We're going to have Solomon, when the temple is built, offering sacrifices. And a whole lot later on, during the period of the what's called the Maccabees, this is kind of, you know, between the Testaments, as it were, you have some of the rulers of the Maccabees assuming both the kingly and the high priestly office. So it's not the first, not the last time this is going to happen. It kind of all goes back to Melchizedek, Genesis 14, who's the priest and the king of Salem. But anyway, David is dressed in priestly garb. and he's dancing and everybody is shouting the sound of the trumpet. And then in the midst of all of this excitement and rejoicing, we have verse 16, which just kind of drops this into the narrative, and it's going to pick it up again in a minute. It says, as it happened, as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, that Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. Now, you would think with that introduced that we would go right to this heated exchange between her and David. We don't. This is one of these cases where the author will drop something into the narrative and kind of pique our interest and then go on with the rest of the narrative and then pick up that particular point of interest again and expand on it.
Yeah, it seems as though what David is doing here must be fairly foolish looking. I mean, the sort of dancing with all your might. So, I mean, he is just getting after it. I mean, that's what the text would have you believe. And, you know, he's leaping and dancing. I mean, this is what my mother would say is like acting a fool. You know this term, Chad?
Yes. Yeah.
I don't think God has a problem with it. Obviously, David's ecstatic and stuff. But, but it might, you know, it might be a weird thing to see a king do. And but David's a weird king. I mean, he's
a weird guy. Yeah. And kind of along these same lines, this linen ephod. Don't kind of picture like a suit. Picture something where, if you're jumping around and you're dancing and you're really busting some moves, there's a pretty good chance that certain parts of your body are going to be exposed.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, for parents listening with kids, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's linen, first of all.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like
you're wearing a long t-shirt.
Yes.
Maybe we could say that. Yes. You're wearing a t-shirt that goes down to mid thigh. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. It's
it's tied up a little bit, but
I was going to say it's like a nightgown essentially.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Yeah. So he's wearing a nightgown and he's, you know, very excited, dancing a lot. So Michal sees this, by the way, out the window. The reason that's important, if you remember back in 1 Samuel chapter 19, this is in the early days when Saul was coming after David, that he sent soldiers to David's house to kill David in bed because Michal had lied and said he's sick. Michal lets David escape through a window. So there's an irony here between these two particular stories. So early in their marriage, she rescued her husband by letting him escape through a window. Now she looks out through a window and sees David playing the fool, as it were. Okay, we'll finish their particular exchange in just a second. Let's see what happens. Verse 17 says they brought the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent which David had pitched for it. This, by the way, is not the tabernacle. We have a weird separation that's going on through a lot of 1 and 2 Samuel. The Ark of God, just the Ark, not all the other stuff, just the Ark, has been at Kiriath Yearim. But the rest of the tabernacle is probably at this point in Gibeon, which is, I've yet to hear a good explanation as to why they were kept apart as long as they were. But they were. So this tent that David sets up is not the tabernacle. It's just a tent that's going to be a house for the Ark of the Covenant. Then they offer burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And after David had offered these burnt offerings and peace offerings, again, more priestly activity on David's part, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord. And he wasn't content just to do that, but he's going to make sure they all have plenty to eat. And so he gives to all the people who were there, he gives them some cake, says some bread, and then some translations will say a cake of dates. ESV says a portion of meat. We're not exactly sure what it was, but either way, they give them some food and then some cake of raisins, and everybody goes to their house. So everybody's happy. They have food. No doubt they have drink. It's been a great celebration. I mean, this is kind of think of if your hometown has like one day a year where there's a parade or just kind of a, you know, a big party, whatever it might be, that's the atmosphere. Everybody's happy. Everything's gone well this time. They've got the Ark there. Everybody loves David. Now everybody's got plenty of food. They're going to go home. Are they going to celebrate? There were peace offerings, which means that with peace offerings, the people got back a portion of the animal that was sacrificed. So there can be barbecue, just kind of picture beer, barbecue. Everybody's happy. Everybody's rejoicing. David's been dancing. Yeah.
Then you go home and you open the front door and your wife's waiting there with her arms crossed.
Yeah.
And you are like, what?
What? Yeah. The look on her face says everything. So yeah, I wanted to set all that up because when we transition to verse 20, it's like, uh-oh. So David gets back and he's returned. He's going to bless his house now. And when he does, his wife comes out to meet him. Michal, the daughter of Saul. Notice how she's constantly called the daughter of Saul. That also is a wink to us. This is Saul's daughter. You know, the Saul that persecuted David, the Saul whose regal line came to an end with the death of Ish-bosheth. That Saul, his daughter, comes out to meet David and says, and you need to hear this with full sarcasm. Oh, how the king of Israel has distinguished himself or honored himself today. He uncovered himself in the eyes of his servants' maids as one of the foolish or empty ones shamelessly uncovers himself. She's not happy.
Yeah, I like the way that the ESV has this where it says, as one of the vulgar fellows shamelessly uncovers himself.
Yeah, it's a good translation for it's yeah, the Hebrew there is rake, which is just kind of like the empty, dull, foolish, yeah, vulgar. Yeah, you kind of picture like, yeah, a guy who's he's drunk and he doesn't care what he covers or doesn't uncover. That's kind of what she's communicating here. You've acted like an idiot out there, David.
Today. And it seems that David thinks that kind of baked into this is my father would never have done that.
Yeah, precisely. And notice this. This just struck me this morning. Why wasn't she out there? If all the people of Israel are celebrating with David and she, you kind of picture her, she's at home. No, I'm not going out there. With her arms crossed, looking out the window, looking down, literally and metaphorically, at David, thinking to herself, yeah, my dad would never behave this way. So you can read your you can read your life verse.
Yeah, this is my life verse. Yeah, David. Well, David, it's coming up. Well, David's response is, it was before the Lord who chose me above your father and above all his house to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, and I will celebrate before the Lord. So he's responding to something that she didn't say, but that he knows is inserted in what she said, which is, yeah. Hey, God chose me and he knew who he was getting. I'm a wild man. Like this is the kind of stuff I'm prone to do. This is sort of like, take it up with God. I'm just doing me. And then says this, which is of course, Chad, my life verse, which is, I will make myself yet more contemptible than this. And I will be abased in your eyes. This is the life verse. So when someone's like, unbelievable that you could act in such a way. Oh, you've seen nothing yet.
Yeah. Hold my beer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You just wait. And I'll do even more abasing, dishonorable things, at least according to your opinion.
Yeah, and by the way, this is probably not how you like go to bed reconciled.
No, and we're told, of course, at the end of the chapter that that she had no child to the day of her death, and we're not told why.
Well, there's one thing that can make sure that you don't have that, and that's if you never reconcile and no baby making activity goes on, which is kind of how I read that.
That's the way I read that this relationship
is essentially ended at this point.
Well, and I can't help but think that David is thinking, you know what? Not just because they had this row and this fight and they didn't reconcile, but at this point, I'm thinking David doesn't want any child around that has any of Saul's heritage.
Yeah.
Any of Saul's genes. So there could be more than one reason why this didn't happen. You know, and I know we're out of time, but I will say this. We kind of picked on Michal here. But in her defense, she's had a pretty rough life. I mean, so David, this is the wife for which he got the 200. He went out and collected 200 Philistine foreskins to have her as his wife.
I'm sure that's part of the argument that doesn't come up. This is not what I went out and got 200 foreskins to put up with.
Yeah. I'm sure he reminds her of that quite often. So, I mean, they probably, judging by that episode I referred to earlier where she let him escape through the window, they probably had a fairly, maybe happy marriage at first. And then after David leaves, then her dad, Saul, gives her to another man. And as we heard just a couple episodes ago, seemed like he's a pretty cool dude. Because when they take her away from that guy, he follows her. He's crying. He's just beside himself, which would suggest that he truly loved her. And now she's back with David, but not the same David she had at the beginning. Because this David now has a harem.
Yeah.
Has all these wives. So... yeah, I only say that because from her perspective, there's a lot going on here that could make her look at David as if, I really don't want to be with you, but here I am.
Yeah, you went from being his first, his wife to one of many wives. And what David's doing here is not regal behavior. I understand the complaint. I mean, she is saying, like, this is not how a king is supposed to act, but... David's a different sort of king, and he says that's exactly how this king's going to act. And that's it, man. We are out of time, and then some. So, guys, we'll be back next week to get into chapter 7. We've been doing a good job of actually completing chapters the last couple of times. Don't get used to it. I'm sure that will be broken soon enough. But we'll be back for the beginning of chapter 7 next week. Chad, I'll see you then.
All right, see you then.